This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula, KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and this is Kenai Garden Talk. From aphids to zucchini, high tunnels to high bush cranberries, selling at farmers markets to putting up produce for winter, we cover anything to do with growing, raising, and producing your own food on the Kenai Peninsula. Yes, this show is airing at 11 a.m. Saturday. We are unfortunately losing our longtime friend Car Talk, which usually airs at this time. After being in reruns for the last 4 years, Car Talk will no longer be distributed at the end of September. But the good news is KDLL is creating new local shows to fill that void. The last Saturday of the month, we've got Drinking on the Last Frontier with Bill Howell, all about craft brewing on the Kenai Peninsula. Starting in May, the third Saturday of the month will be Adventure Talks, about the trials, trails, and travels of Kenai Peninsula residents. And the second Saturday of the month is Kenai Garden Talk. This week, we've got tips to help home gardeners spring into action, and some advice for farmers to grow their business. By the calendar, it's spring. Yes, there is still snow on the ground. And yes, there is weeks of muck underneath that still needs to dry out. But as experienced Alaska gardeners know, now is the time to get your seeds started. How do you do that? Some trial and error is required, but advice from someone who's already tried and erred and learned from those experiences can help. Though Margaret Simone grew up on a farm in South Dakota, she wasn't much interested in gardening.
I was the little girl that weeded and watered, and I didn't really care that much for gardening. I think I liked to play in the dirt, really. I was more concerned with making mud pies and that kind of thing than actually what grew.
But when she moved to the Kenai Peninsula in 1963 and saw the lack of variety and freshness of produce in the grocery store, she was willing to give it a try. After a few false starts, and with the help from her neighbor, homesteader Jesse Ainsworth, she started cultivating a green thumb.
I tried to grow things that would grow in South Dakota that don't grow here, like corn. You know, you get hungry for that corn on the cob. Jesse encouraged me probably by giving me starts of stuff that did well, and then it just becomes trial and error.
Now her garden, overlooking Island Lake in Nikiski, is expansive, with flower beds, raised vegetable beds, fences and chicken wire to keep the moose and neighborhood animals at bay, and a greenhouse. She grows the staple Alaska crops, carrots, cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, and the like, and is successful with the fussier plants, leeks, tomatoes, cucumbers. She also likes to experiment and has had some exotic success.
Last summer, I had 5 artichokes fresh to eat. Not the big kind that you get at the grocery store, but baby artichokes. But even that, the quality of the taste is really noticeable when you go pick it off the plant and cook it immediately and it isn't in the store for 3 weeks.
Simone waves off any descriptions of being a master gardener. She says she doesn't have any secret techniques, and certainly doesn't spend any more money than she has to. She's pretty pragmatic about the whole thing.
My technique is a philosophy that I tell my plants, you either adapt or die. And that's kind of where it's at with me. I'm a pretty basic, maybe lazy gardener. I don't go to a lot of extremes to make things grow. If I put it in the ground and it wants to grow, it will. And if something doesn't work year one, I'll try it again year two, maybe in a different spot. And if it still doesn't work, the third year it's out. 3 strikes, you're out. 3 and out.
But she does give her plants the best start that she can by starting them inside. Doing so requires 3 elements for success: moisture, light, and medium. Don't overwater, Simone says.
The watering is pretty critical when you're seed starting. If you have the medium too wet, the seeds rot. And if they do come up, then you may have that damping off where they die at the ground level.
Light gives energy for starts to grow. Simone uses regular old shop lights and keeps them on her seedlings 16 to 18 hours a day.
And only about 3 inches from the actual plant so that they don't have that legginess. So when you set up your situation, you want to have a chain or something that you can lift up a couple at a time or drop down to accommodate the height of your plants.
The third key to success is the medium in which starts are planted. First off, know how deep to place the seed.
The smaller the seed, generally speaking, the less depth it has to be or no depth at all. Like if you have a big pumpkin, you want to plant deeper, of course, than your tiny, because they kind of get there and don't know what to do when they're buried.
Simone sprouts her seeds in garden variety, 6-slot plastic containers, but quickly moves them to bigger pots.
They get root bound and they just become unhealthy. They're starving. You can see there's not a lot of soil there, so they've probably used up all the nutrients in that soil and they just need a new boost.
As for timing, it varies by plant. Simone starts tomatoes in February, and by the end of March had leeks, artichokes, and various flowers already started. But now is the time for the majority of seed starting.
April 1 to April 15 is the major time of planting seeds for me. I always figure I can plant out by the end of May. Memorial Day is the big planting weekend, as everybody knows, in Alaska. The last couple of years, it's been warm enough where I've been planting mid-May. Sometimes I'm not sure that's worth it, however, because I think the plants just kind of sit out there and shiver.
Some plants will go straight to the greenhouse, like tomatoes and cucumbers, while others are bound for her raised beds outside. As a rule of green thumb, Simone likes to wait until the soil is 50 to 55 degrees before she transplants her starts into the ground. She recommends putting thought into where they'll go before they go. Research each plant, that's what Google is for, she says, to find out how much sun, shade, and drainage they like, and what kind of soil is best.
Of course, the soil is always number one. If you've got an acidic soil and you want to grow something that doesn't like acid, it isn't going to work. So, and have a soil test, you know, if you're going to get serious about this business, you know, do it right.
There's an intermediate step before the starts go in the ground.
What they call hardening off, and that's to put them in a cooler, protected area. I always put them on my side deck that gets a late afternoon sun for at least a week or 10 days.
Some crops can be started from seeds planted directly in the ground, like carrots, beets, and rutabaga. For those, Simone likes to use seed tape to keep her spacing consistent.
Try to put them far enough apart so that if they all came up, they'd have room. And that has worked pretty well for me just because, like I said, I don't like to thin, and I don't want to kill those little babies. So try to do it right.
There are a lot of variations on this trick, but basically, cut strips of paper towel as long as your garden plot. For Simone, that's 8 feet. And fold the strips in half. Space your seeds according to the packet's recommendation along one edge of the paper towel. Simone does a couple of inches between carrot seeds. Keep the seeds in place with a dab of Elmer's glue and press the top fold of the paper towel down onto the glue to hold everything together. When it's dry, bury the strips in a shallow furrow in the ground and give them some water.
When it gives it more moisture to get it off to a little better start in the ground.
Once things are in the ground or in the greenhouse, if they were started well, it's just a matter of weeding, watering, and maintenance until it's time to harvest. After being a reluctant garden tender as a kid, Simone grew into someone who likes that part of the process.
It has been my therapy for many years. When I was working, it was just cheaper than going to a therapist. Well, I'm not sure it was cheaper. Actually, gardening can be kind of costly, but it was certainly therapeutic. I could talk to the plants and they didn't sass back, you know. So.
Even before Simone retired, she made time for her plants. She was the librarian at Kenai Central High School for many years. And she says that's an important consideration before any seeds get started.
I think that if you're seriously looking at gardening, the first thing that you really need to consider, I believe, is how much time you have to devote to the process, because it's not low maintenance or no work if you want to succeed. So decide how much you want to do, then find a place to do it, and then maybe do the best you can. Get the information and you know, just baby those babies.
Coming up next, success on a commercial farm means much more than just producing a successful crop. There's a whole host of considerations to balance to keep your business growing. A nationally recognized organic farmer, educator, and author is in Kenai this weekend to help. Welcome back. I'm Jenny Nyman, and this is Kenai Garden Talk on KDLL 91.9 FM, Kenai Soldotna. Having a successful commercial farm takes more than just producing a good crop. Whether it's a small-scale high tunnel selling to farmers markets or a larger operation supplying grocery stores, there are several other factors to tend that don't have anything to do with what comes out of the dirt. Luckily, there are resources to help plan for and navigate all these considerations from people who have been there, done that themselves. The Kenai Soil and Water Conservation District is offering a workshop today in Kenai to help local producers grow their businesses. The presenter is Atina Diffley, an organic farmer, educator, activist, and author of Turn Here Sweet Corn, Organic Farming Works. It's a memoir based on she and her husband's lives running the Garden of Egan Organic Vegetable Farm in Minnesota, one of the first certified organic produce farms in the Midwest. Now she travels around the country, helping other farmers put the knowledge she's cultivated to good use. Her workshop is wide-ranging, covering post-harvest handling, food safety, and marketing. She joined us by phone before the workshop to talk about what all this means to small-scale commercial farms like those on the Kenai Peninsula. Welcome, Atina. Thank you for making time to talk. So let's get the basics out of the way. What is post-harvest handling, and why is that important?
Post-harvest handling really includes everything we do from harvest on, and it has a huge impact on the quality of the product, how long its shelf life is, and how fresh it stays. So for an area like Alaska, this is very crucial because you have so much of your product is shipped in. That's a shipped in product that your farmers are, in a sense, competing with. And so we promote local farms as being fresh. But if we don't have good post-harvest handling and proper cooling, we can lose a lot of quality.
How critical is it to properly care for produce immediately after it's harvested?
Well, it really depends upon the crop. Some crops have longer shelf lives than others, but we think about this first step really when we think about respiration of a crop, because different crops have different respiration rates. You know, if you think about our own respiration process, if you just feel the back of your hand for a second and notice the moisture and the temperature, and then breathe on your hand a little bit, give it some good, hard, hot, heavy respiration. I encourage the audience to do this while we talk about it. And then feel your hand and notice what changed. You'll notice that your hand is moist and warm. And so that moisture is given off during your respiration, our human respiration process. And vegetables do the same thing. They respire after they harvest it because they're still alive. Harvesting doesn't actually end their life, but they begin the process towards death and dying. And so that is what this post-harvest process is all about, is slowing the deterioration process that happens after harvest. Something like berries, they might have a 1 or 2 day shelf life, or a potato might have a 9 or 18 month shelf life. So we make different decisions based on the crop.
How do you go about setting up cooling and storage facilities that won't break the bank?
Well, that's one of the challenges for small farms is cooling facilities can be pricey, and so we try to create options and solutions that are scale appropriate and cost effective. For some farms, it might actually mean not choosing to grow crops that are high respiration crops and very vulnerable to cooling. that might be the most cost-effective strategy if they're very small, to just stay away from those crops. For other crops, it might mean having a room cooler, and we can bring costs down by using a nifty little tool called a CoolBot, which works with an air conditioner to make a room cooler. It might involve using water. It might involve time of day that we harvest. Can do a lot to get the crop out of the field before the heat of the day. So it's very crop specific.
You provide some resources on your website about respiration rates at various temperatures for various crops, and they differ quite a bit. Potatoes have a low respiration rate, tomatoes are moderate, snap beans are high, and broccoli is very high. And storage recommendations vary widely as well. Potatoes should be kept at 50 degrees, tomatoes at 62, snap beans at 45 degrees, and broccoli at 32. Yet these are all crops that might be produced by one farm. So how does a farmer create optimal cooling and storage conditions without having a separate facility for each crop?
Well, often they don't need to because they're not storing it on the farm. So we think about this in terms of process. There's harvest, there's cleaning, there's cooling, and there's storing. So cooling is maybe done in the same space as storing. Sometimes we put something in a room cooler, and that's cooling it. And then once it's cool, it stays there, and it's in storage. But they're different processes. So on most small farms, in the heat of the season, we don't store. We might harvest lettuce, cool it, and then we ship it. So it doesn't need a different storing facility, and we can cool things. A good example would be a cucumber, which has a ideal storage temperature around 45 or 50, so it's not 32 degrees like many crops. We can cool a cucumber in a 34-degree room. It won't hurt the cucumber until it goes below its storage ideal storage temperature, just like we can walk outside in 32-degree weather. As you well know in Alaska, I'm sure you get cold weather. It doesn't hurt you unless your body temperature drops below a safe level. So often farms don't need to have too many different situations unless they're actually holding it long term. So the trick is to get that field heat out and then get it to market cool. And so one challenge that small farmers have is if they don't cool properly, the product might look great when it leaves them because they just picked it and it didn't have time to deteriorate yet. But it may not hold up in the customer's refrigerator or system. And I often hear from farmers market shoppers and from wholesale buyers that they don't want to buy local because it doesn't last as long. There's generally no reason it shouldn't last as long if it's been handled properly. So that's really a handling question. And there are a few exceptions to that. A crop like strawberries grown in dry California conditions will have a longer shelf life than a strawberry grown in humid conditions. But for most crops, if it's handled properly, the same storage life should be accomplishable.
Along with post-harvest handling to preserve quality and freshness, you also cover produce handling in terms of food safety. What do local farmers need to be aware of in that realm?
Many of the farmers in your region are probably aware that we now have food safety regulations that affect produce farmers. My understanding about the size of the farms is that most of them are probably exempt from these regulations or in a category called qualified exempt, which means they are not necessarily required to be in compliance with the law. And it's important that they know exactly what their legal obligations are. And even though they may be exempt from the law or not required to be in compliance, we as farmers are food handlers, and I'm a farmer myself, so I'm speaking from the collective that we are food handlers and responsible for the safety of the food produced. So what does that actually mean, and how might we accomplish that in a way that is scale appropriate, cost effective? So if you're paying attention, you might have noticed now that I've said scale appropriate, cost effective about four times already. Everything we look at on a small farm has to fit that parameter, and food safety is one of them. So how do we really address this through the lens of risk assessment? Because just because there's a risk on our farm doesn't mean we have a problem, and it doesn't mean we have to do something about it. We want to understand where the potential risks are. I'm using the word potential. And then understand how it could move from where it is to get onto the food, assess whether that's an issue or not, how likely, how serious. And then if we decide it is a risk that we do need to manage, we just talk about what to do about it. So hand washing is the greatest example there is. It's a high risk activity going to the bathroom. It's highly likely that we could get a contamination on our hand that would make a human being sick. and it would be a serious consequence if it happened. So we have hand washing stations. We provide those to our workers, and we make rules on the farm that people are required to wash their hands after they go to the bathroom. That's a risk assessment and a planned action that we take to reduce that likelihood that someone would get sick. So that's really how we look at risk assessments, and it takes the edge off of it for people. It's not just a bunch of rules. It's really understanding how our farms function and how we can do it in a way that's going to be most efficient for ourselves and lead to our success.
The last thing you cover is marketing. What does that mean for smaller scale commercial operations like we have on the Kenai Peninsula? Is it putting a sign out on the road, having a website, handing out flyers at a farmer's market, or something more?
It's really understanding who our customers are, what is the value, and what do they need, so that we are really addressing that and meeting that customer's personal needs rather than selling around the edge as far as external needs. If we're not hitting it on the bullseye, it can be hard to really develop loyalty and a premium relationship.
Can you give some examples of how you would approach marketing differently if you sell at a farmer's market versus if you have a subscription service where people come pick up boxes of whatever you've got fresh at the moment versus supplying a local restaurant or store?
Map up their customer base, who they are, what do they care about, and then tracking out those needs and values. And it becomes multi-layered when we sell to a store or a restaurant. If we're selling direct, that end customer, then that end customer at a farmer's market or CSA, their needs are the only ones that we're really addressing. But if we sell to a store or a restaurant, now you have two layers of needs. So use the store for an example. Their end customer who buys from that store, they might say one of their highest needs are flavor, but the grocery store, one of their highest needs is going to be shelf life. And if that crop that is grown that has great flavor doesn't have shelf life, the store's needs for shelf life are going to trump the end consumer's needs for flavor. So we want to look at each of the different players in our market and really understand what they do need so that we're actually making sure we match them. It could happen that we have customers that really care about our production practices, that we're not using chemicals, et cetera, and that might match up with us. But you can see how if they don't care and we care, then we are selling to someone that doesn't have the same value of the value that we're selling. So how do we then get them to pay a premium for that product? They're not going to think it's worth anything and a premium if they don't have that same value. So how do we move them then to valuing that or move to another market or change or modify our own farms?
Is it possible to compete with the big guys, the chain grocery stores that can offer lower prices than a local farmer probably can? Is that where marketing comes in?
That is exactly where marketing comes in, because there's three basic things we can offer our customers. We can offer them price, and Walmart offers them price. We can't be Walmart. It's absolutely not possible for us to do it, and we shouldn't even try. It's not about price. We're not going to stay in business. The other area we can compete is on service. Now, how many people out there think they can be Walmart on service? I think they all have that capacity. And service is very layered. Convenience falls under service. And convenience isn't just, you know, food that's already chopped up. It's where do you get the food? Is that easy to get? Is it already washed? There's so many components of convenience. Service, delivery. Then there is quality, another area where small farms in the region should be able to beat a store like Walmart. So Walmart can get you on price. They cannot beat you on service and quality. And when we really understand that the food we are selling is a commodity and the understanding of the customer's values and needs, that's where we receive our premium. If we're going to get above the national pricing game or the local shipped-in product that we're competing with, we have to understand those needs and values of that end consumer and really be able to meet them on a consistent basis with the farm-identified products that they know where they can get. That's really what leads us to receiving a premium. That premium might be a price premium, or it might be a commitment premium. I see loyalty and knowing that I have a customer who absolutely is going to buy the product. That is a premium for me because I can build my farm around that. I can write a budget and make infrastructure decisions if I know that I actually will sell the product versus just planning a bunch of food and hoping that I sell it, but not sure that I will.
So there's a lot to balance here. Service versus price, finding a client base that matches your mission or matching your mission to available clients and marketing all of this. How do you balance all these elements to improve business?
For farms and profitability, there's three basic ways to become more profitable. We can lower our cost of production. So if we're selling something for a dollar and it costs us 50 cents to produce it, if we can lower that to 30 cents, we make an extra 20 cents for every time we sell it. We can sell more units. So if we're making 50 cents per unit, we sell more of them, we sell more 50 centers, and it adds up. Or we can raise our prices. And lowering our cost of production is fundamental to every farm's success. That just absolutely has to happen. And that's largely about efficiency and really understanding efficiency through every single layer of our production systems. But the raising price one is very interesting because there are some fine balances between raising prices and losing customers and creating an identity around the farm that it's very expensive. But there's ways to raise prices that can sort of skirt that. One way is to add services at the store level so the end customer might not see a change. An example was I was working with a farmer in Havre, Montana, a pretty small town, and probably somewhat similar to Alaska with the sense that there was a limited population that the farmer was going to be able to sell to. So just selling more units really wasn't a big option. And he was selling to a grocery store, and he was stocking the shelf for the store and taking away any spoilage. So he was reducing the store's labor expenses and reducing their risk for loss. And so he needed to get a larger portion of the value that the customer paid than he would get if he just dropped the food at the dock. So you see right there, he provided a value to the store, to the buyer, that he needs to be paid for. So it's an example of raising his price by providing a value, a service to that store.
There is a lot of good information here, and you've got even more on your website, atinadifley.com. That's AtinaDiffley. Both under the Resources tab and the Public Speaking and Workshops page, which is under your About tab, and your book is available to order on your website as well. Thank you for making time to talk today.
Thanks. Thanks for the call.
Don't go planting yet. We've got tips for budding gardeners from experts with the Central Peninsula Garden Club. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Kenai Garden Talk on KDLL 91.9 FM, listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. I'm Jenny Nyman, and we just heard from Atina Diffley, sharing strategies for growing local farm success. But not everyone is at the level of a full-fledged farm. Most of us this time of year are thinking about what we can do to make our gardens successful. It's easy to pick up some seed packets, but not always easy to pick an expert's brain when we have questions about what to do with those seeds and how to care for what grows. Well, the Central Peninsula Garden Club is here to help. The club held its annual roundtable event, March 25th, at the Kenai Visitors and Cultural Center for inquiring gardeners to get their questions answered. Here's Garden Club President Renee Wall explaining how the event works.
Today we have our Get Ready for Spring Roundtables event. We have 11 tables with different topics with a gardening expert at each table. And people are just coming in and they can go and pick and choose what they're interested in and learn more about that topic, ask questions. It's a great chance to talk one-on-one with someone who knows what they're doing. People are really interested in getting going for the spring, which is why we choose now to do it. So anything to do with getting their garden started, seed starting is usually really popular. Compost, planting, that sort of thing. We have some people with PhDs and we have some to help give information. And then there's people who have just learned through the School of Hard Knocks and they can speak to the whole range of expertise. And things are just different in Alaska, and that's something that it's a challenge for people when they move up here. it just doesn't happen quite the same as it does in Oregon or California. So there is a learning curve, and our members, farmers here, growers here, have tried it and done it, and it's just a lot better to get it, you know, hands-on information than trying to reinvent the wheel every time. We've had a good show. Just constant flow of people in, just come and go as you please, and it's going really well.
As Renee Wall says, gardening in Alaska is a different experience than in the lower 48. Ray and Moni Price have discovered that the hard way, but even though they've had a fair share of error in their trials, they're still working at it.
Well, just learning. We moved up here from Oregon. Down there, you put a seed in the ground, it grows. And you go to Alaska, don't work that way.
What are some lessons you've learned the hard way?
How you build your soil. And actually, I think I've learned more today from being here listening to the people than I was able to help them. So, and trial and error is the biggest thing.
Have you had a plant that you thought maybe from your experience in Oregon you knew when it should go in the ground and you were surprised that, oh, that didn't work in Alaska?
Yeah, well, down we live in western Oregon, so your ground don't freeze. As soon as it gets dry enough, you can go out and plant, and it'll grow. But up here, you need, your ground is still frozen. We still have, 2 feet of snow? Everything is later. To us, it's been trial and error, and I made a lot of errors.
Usually we put it in the ground, then we find out whether we're right or wrong.
And she gets anxious and wants to get planting because, you know, we're used to April or whatever, you start planting. Well, up here it don't work that way. And she might have plants sitting in the house that tall already and don't have a place to put them. You know, you're going to make a lot of mistakes, but learn by your mistakes. And something I see most of them do is they keep a log from year to year as to how things go and when to plant.
Just don't give up.
And something fresh out of the garden tastes so much better than out of the store.
Our first stop is Tamara Leach. She's a garden club member and is certified in permaculture design. She's here to tell people about
permaculture and hugelkulturs.
And obvious question,
what is a hugelkultur? A hugelkultur is a raised bed that you build on top of a wood pile, which most Alaskans have brush and wood piles all around their property. So it's a really quick and easy method to get a raised bed that has a lot of good soil that you can grow a lot of things in.
Permaculture, what's important to know about that for Alaskans?
The important thing about permaculture for Alaskans is most of them have already been doing it. Most of our homesteaders, it's a way of farming the land that's going to be sustainable for as long as possible. So self-reliance.
And what are some of the ways people can do that?
Well, use what you have around you. If you have brush piles, by all means, build a hugelkultur. If you don't, put in a conventional garden with a high tunnel if you have room. If you live in the city and neither one of those is an option, maybe try out some chickens. It's about using what you have. Everyone has brush piles and a lot of, I never thought about it like that. How much soil do we need? What can you grow on it? Which a lot of it, if you have down trees, get a cat out there, just push the dirt right on top and throw some seeds in. It works. Potatoes love it. I have put in lettuce. The first year when I was dog tired and couldn't grow anything else after I finally got one up, I just threw Alaska wildflower seeds on it. So whatever you have.
So no digging, no clearing ground, no clearing brush, no nothing. You already have a brush pile and that's a garden ready to go.
If you have just a big brush pile and a bag of dirt, toss it on a small corner of it. Start small. You don't have to build a huge one to begin with. You don't have to put down any kind of weed blocker. The types of trees you could have pop up through there might be some willow. But in general, just grow something that's going to cover it real fast. Like I said, the potatoes, you could throw mustard down there. I haven't had any problems with the actual trees themselves trying to grow through it. I never fertilize it. The tree breaks down within there slowly over the course of years, leaching nutrients into the soil. So, nope, I never fertilize. compared to the amount of work I have to put into the beds that are in the high tunnel versus I put the potatoes in the ground and then I leave them alone until it's time to pull up, I get a pretty good yield. If you have questions, you don't know how to spell or pronounce Hügel culture, that's German for hill culture, just look for raised beds on a brush pile. If you have access to the internet, you have access to all sorts of cool ideas and projects. I say get outside and just try something. Try something new, because then you'll know what questions you might have.
Up next, no matter what you choose to grow, healthy soil is a must. Here's Fritz Miller with TNT Certified Organic Compost talking about how to make and maintain your own compost pile.
We have a big rock of Alaska, and our organic soils are very thin and they're very hard to come by. You can scrape up a lot of ground in Alaska and not come up with very much topsoil. Without some kind of nutrients, it will not grow, and you have your choice between chemical nutrients or compost, which is organic nutrients, and the compost will provide the minerals and the needed micronutrients in your food that your chemicals will not. So that's why we want to compost. They can make their own compost at home, collecting their grass clippings, their leaves, their garden scraps, their table scraps, get it in a bin and turn it with a pitchfork and make it into dirt. It takes about 2 years. Usually, it's not recommended to use any animal offal that are not herbal eaters. Dogs and cats are a no. Some meat products are a no. Some lawn clippings that have had herbicides, feed and seed, lawn, good stuff that everyone from outside likes to put on their lawn, can leave those residues in your compost. So you want to be careful with that.
What mistakes do you see people making?
Their piles are not quite big enough, and they don't turn them often enough to keep them hot. They should remain at 140 degrees for 4 or 5 days at a minimum. Pile should be typically 3 cubic feet, and it needs to have the right CNN ratio, which is about 25% nitrogen, and that needs to be turned for as long as it takes for that pile to mature as compost and stay hot. And once it's turned and has enough oxygen in it, it will mature and it will quit being hot. And so that's an important part. They just don't turn them enough.
So what do you do in the winter? You're saying it takes about 2 years to get down to compost?
Cover the pile with a tarp, and a whole different set of microbes work on it all winter long. You can plant directly in good compost. I do. It's hard to afford to do that, and I recommend using a nice handful of compost under each plant. Good mature compost has got nutrients in it for at least 3, 4 to 5 years, depending upon what the nutrients are. So it lasts. It's been microbially broke down, and it will service you and your garden for a long time.
Should you be adding new things to the pile as it's going along, or once you get a pile of a good enough size, you just start a new pile somewhere else?
You can do both. Typically, you'd like to get a pile and start turning it in the spring throughout the summer and leave it alone and let it mature and start another pile for the next year. It's an important part to have compost for organic gardening, for all the micronutrients we need in our food, which we don't get in our commercially, chemically grown products.
Okay, soil is taken care of. But before we get planting, there's something else to consider, and that's garden planning and crop rotation. This is Velma Biddick to explain why a little thought in the winter is invaluable come summer.
The problem up here that we have that is a real problem is with our brassicas and our cabbage family, because they are susceptible to root maggot, and so rotation and maintenance is a really, really important thing, just so that it doesn't carry over to the next year. So there's some techniques that you can use to keep those under control.
So crop rotation sounds like a lot of work. What is the benefit behind it to offset the amount of time and effort you're going to be putting into doing that?
Every plant requires different nutrients, different growing conditions, and harbors certain pests and diseases. So by rotating, you take the pressure off for nutrients because every plant uses different nutrients. You don't harbor an environment that is conducive to one kind of pest. If you move things around, then the pest has to move too, and if you can stay one step ahead of him, then you're better off.
When you're rotating, are you leaving a section with nothing in it to give the soil a chance to rest, or you're constantly having something growing everywhere?
If you enrich your soil with compost and you've got a comprehensive renewable program going, then you don't have to fallow. You just use a low feeder, a crop that doesn't require intense nutrients, as a fallow year. That way you still get some production, but you still allow the soil to rest. And then if it's a short-term crop like lettuce or radishes or something like that, you can go in behind and do a green manure to help on short-season crops.
And you're saying that folks with smaller gardening spaces probably have it tougher for crop rotation. How should they go about it?
Sometimes it's easier to rotate in a big layout than it is a small one. High tunnels are especially problematic because you don't have a lot of space. You're trying to put a lot of sensitive climate-tender plants inside. The outdoor areas are a little better. The easiest way is to divide your growing area into three. That's assuming that you grow potatoes. Potatoes are a big crop up here. So a third of your garden spot is potatoes, a third is brassicas, cabbage, broccoli. Maybe you have to go a little bit longer than that. Potatoes up here are pretty easy to grow. They have very few pests as of now. As long as you have certified seeds so you don't have disease problems, you can overlap the potatoes. You don't really want to overlap brassicas. You can get in trouble with your rotation with successive planting. I know people who have set up a beautiful rotation crop with a third potatoes, a third brassicas, and a third other, which is celery and parsley and beets and carrots and onions, and because they get a space and they go, oh, I'm going to plant radishes here, or I'm going to plant kale, and those are brassicas, and they're host to the root maggot. So you have to be really careful when you successive plant that you don't contaminate your clean areas with two or three plants that are going to harbor that root maggot.
When is this rotation happening? Is this an early spring thing? Is it after you're done for the season?
Once you get a comprehensive plan set up, it becomes much simpler. There have been times where I've spent a goodly part of winter trying to figure out where I was going to plant something. It's much easier to have a rotation where you've got five crops than 40 crops. So that's where it's important to know what plants are in what family and what plants harbor the same pests. And that can be done with research, checking in your seed catalogs to find out which diseases run in families and how to manage those. It's kind of like a story problem or an algebraic equation. You just kind of have to sit down and work it out until you find something that works for you, your crops, and your soil area. There's a lot to do in the wintertime.
So it sounds like good record keeping, good note taking is probably pretty important to keep up on this. Do you have a system that you recommend for people to map out and keep track of what they're doing?
I keep logs. I think my logs in this location go back to about 89. But it's the last 5 or 6 years that are really important. I write down almost everything. I've got a big calendar that hangs on my entryway wall, and I write down almost everything, even if it's just a note, because you think you won't forget, I'll guarantee you will. And then those bits of information are put into a journal that makes more sense, that's cleaned up. That's another winter project. You start collating all of the stuff that you write down. I try to keep a spiral ring notebook that's down at the greenhouse in the high tunnel so that I can write things down. And it gets pretty weather-worn by the time summer's over. It's wet and the lines disappear, and I always use a pencil because it doesn't smudge. But those little pieces of errant information, they're worth their weight in gold in the wintertime when you're trying to remember what was going on in July and September. Become familiar with the plant families. Everybody grows different products, and you might find that the products that you're growing and the selections that you're growing are very easy to set up a crop rotation plan. I grow about 75 different varieties of plants, and so it can get to be a really complicated situation, but it will pay dividends in your soil health and your pest problems.
All right, now it's time to grow. Some plants are a little more intimidating than others, but they don't have to be. Katrina Nelson with O'Brien Garden and Trees says that apple trees are an easy entry into fruit growing.
So what do you do to grow an apple tree around here?
We hand graft all of our trees. So we use a very hardy rootstock to survive the cold temperature. And then you get your varieties from there. We have over 20 varieties of apples that will grow outside. And if you have a high tunnel, you're more so towards maybe 100 range. First thing, protect it from the moose. Right. Next is your soil. You need to have good soil, nice amendments. Loose soil, traditionally, you don't want to, all of our soil here in Alaska is a lot of clay, so you want to, of course, mend it. You're going to build it. You might want to take a soil class if you're a beginner. Some sand, some peat, and other amendments, whatever your gardening techniques are. And with that, just give it love and appreciate it.
When is a good time to plant?
I traditionally say anytime between Memorial Day and Labor Day. Once a year, you do need to feed your trees. We deplete on nitrogen and phosphorus extremely every year in Alaska. And the springtime is the best time.
As the season goes along, are there other kind of care things that you should be doing for your trees?
It depends on the age of your tree and where it's located. High tunnel, you need to look more at pest management than you maybe do outside just because it's an enclosed environment. So bugs, soil, those are things you'd have to look for.
How long after you plant would you expect to get fruit? Are they going to fruit within a year?
It depends on the age of the tree. We sell different ages. If you have a first-year grafted tree, you will have to wait 2-3 years before you get blossoms.
Okay, and at the end of the season, I mean, you pick, that's the highlight. What do you do for your trees? Do you need to do anything to get them ready for winter?
Nope, do nothing. Yeah, pretty low maintenance. The first thing is protect it from the moose, and your tree should live a very long time.
If you're looking for a crop that produces all season long, consider herbs. Yes, they're a little delicate, but they don't take much care to create big flavor. This is Tracy Poitry.
I have been talking for the last 3.5 hours nonstop. I'm getting worn out. It's been fun, though. People just asking about why they don't have a lot of luck with herbs. People think a lot of hot sun is a good thing, and it's just too much. Your herbs are delicate, and they just can't handle it. I have a greenhouse that my husband built for me, and I have a lot of luck in there. Yeah, out in the weather, the wind and the sun is just too harsh, too much for them. The greenhouse gives you that growing environment, so you have a little better chance. The moose don't come along and eat it. Herbs tend to dry out pretty rapidly. You got to keep an eye on the water. Keep them out of that really harsh sun, or they'll dry out really fast. And don't over-fertilize them. You don't want to overdo it. A lot of people have asked about rosemary today. It's more of a shrub, and it's just a little different to deal with. You don't need to water it quite as much. It doesn't dry out as much. And I bring mine in the winter, and it sits on the counter just like a houseplant.
What kinds of problems are you hearing from people today?
That they bolt. In certain varieties, your cilantro will bolt. Alaska, we have very long growing days, and it will encourage your plants to grow really tall and spindly and flower. You're not growing herbs for the flowers. You're growing herbs because you want the big, flavorful leaves. So they tend to bolt. Like your spinach will bolt if you plant it really early. You want to wait a little later in the growing season when our days aren't getting longer. Our days are actually starting to get shorter. And just pick them back. Don't be afraid to pinch them and use them. And if they bolt really bad, don't be afraid to replant and start over. All of June and into July, you've got plenty of growing season. I've got seeds going now, and I'll continue into April getting the seeds going. And then I'll go to a 4-inch plant in the house. And then when May hits, I'll put them in a bigger, like an 8-inch, and get them in the greenhouse. And they'll thrive out there then. Just depends. Every growing season here seems to be different. But May, once the evenings aren't quite so cold, you'll be okay. Depends. If your greenhouse is heated, you might be able to get, you know, a jump start even sooner. I grow them the full season. I still had oregano and thyme in October last year in my greenhouse. I was amazed because it was getting below freezing and they were still out there thriving.
So what all do you grow?
I have dill and cilantro and a lot of different basils, a couple different parsleys. I've got oregano and thyme and some cat grass I'm going to get going for the kitty, different types of mint. I have really learned to love basil, all the different flavors of basil. There's lemon and lime basil, there's a Thai basil. Sage is one I never have enough of, so I'm going to plant probably 3 or 4 more sage plants this year. When the holidays roll around, you can't have enough sage.
So it sounds like your cooking is seldom under-seasoned.
No, we definitely use a lot of herbs at our house, definitely. No shortage. I'll pick and use as the summer goes on, and then in the fall, I'll pick what's left and dehydrate it, and I end up with enough to keep me going all through the winter. Don't be afraid to try it. Just start out, learn from your mistakes. You make mistakes, you'll learn how to do it the next time, and you know, pick the ones that you have success with and enjoy them.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Hey, thank you.
The Central Peninsula Garden Club meets at 7 p.m. the second Tuesday of the month, September through April, at the Cook Inlet Aquaculture Building on Kalifornsky Beach Road. There's a different topic each month, and the programs are free to attend. Even though the regular meetings take a break during growing season, the club still offers advice and learning opportunities. Visit their website at senpengardenclub.org or follow them on Facebook. And to connect with this show, visit KDLL on Facebook, ask a question, suggest a topic, and let us know what you think. You can also find KDLL online at kdll.org, where we'll be posting podcast versions of all our new shows. Thanks for tuning in. Join us for next month's Kenai Garden Talk on May 13th. Until then, according to Janet Kilburn Phillips, there are no gardening mistakes, only experiments. Enjoy the sunshine.